Energy Transition Now with David Linden.
Hello and welcome, everyone. You're listening to Energy Transition Now, back by popular demand and now in its fourth series. I'm your host, David Linden, the head of energy transition for the Westwood Global Energy Group. Now, here at Westwood, we have a whole team of people analysing and opining on the offshore wind sector. But while the sector has pretty much grown exponentially, more than 99% of the time, the wind turbines themselves are what we call fixed bottom, so where the foundation essentially are fixed or directly connected to the seabed. Nevertheless, the industry itself talks a lot about the future being floating. To discuss essentially what that means, I'm really pleased to have Alex Gaunt here with me, the supply chain director of Sierco Energy, here with me today. Hello, Alex.
Hello, David, and hello, listeners. Thank you very much for inviting me on this podcast. Some fantastic work you guys have been doing. I've been listening to some podcasts earlier this week, and it's just brilliant to be part of this. Thank you again for the invite.
No problems at all. No problems at all. It's great to have the opportunity to have folks like yourself essentially, talk through with our listeners all the good things that you guys are doing. So I would say thank you more to you for taking the time to do that. So much appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Perfect. So we've had people from different companies do different things come onto the podcast, but not maybe everyone would have heard of your company that you're working for right now.
Absolutely.
That depends if you're in the offshore wind industry or not, of course. But maybe can you just explain who Sierco Energy actually are and then what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Sierco is a pure play renewable energy developer. What that means insofar as the projects that we're working on at the moment is concerned, is we specialize in going and identifying areas where we can plant flags to create offshore wind opportunities for the future. Now, we've decided to focus most of our efforts on the floating wind. We also own a fixed bottom offshore wind farm called the Fourth Wind Demonstrator. But at the moment, the majority of my time is spent absolutely in the floating wind aspects. Sierco is part of a joint venture with SBM, and we have a company called Fluventus, and Fluventus is developing the Clear, that's double L-Y with a hat, and R, okay. Welsh projects, gotcha. Clear 1 and 2 off the Celtic coast, about 40 kilometers off Pembrokeshire, and we're also developing the Cademo demonstrator project, which is a 4-turbine floater off the west coast of the USA.
Okay, and the word demonstrated will be an important one there for the rest of our, I think, discussion as well, just to give you an indicative as to where we are in the industry in some respects. And maybe just to ask you yourself as well, in terms of your role within the company, what is it that you're currently responsible for? If you've got sort of supply chain director as your title, what is it you kind of do day to day?
Yeah, I mean, the supply chain director is a very exciting role for the company in the sense that, I've spent about 18 years in the offshore wind sector myself. And roughly half my career, I was in the development side of things, where I sort of semi-jokingly say I made promises that supply chain would then have to keep. And then I spent the other half of my career in the supply chain, primarily looking at the power cable sector and, the supply and installation of inter-array cables and export cables, that sort of thing. And I realized very swiftly that I was having to, fulfill promises that developers made, and sometimes that was not possible. So I kind of see my role with Sierco as a supply chain director to find that really comfortable middle ground where we can have a high-value offshore wind project, floating offshore wind project, that is a buildable project. Taking the reality of the constructability aspect and the philosophies around that to apply those through the consenting process right through into the operations.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Again, I think, again, very relevant to floating wind as we'll talk through it as to what some of the opportunities, but also the challenges are and the kind of thing you're dealing with, I guess, part of that. So thank you. Very, very interesting indeed, Alex. So let's maybe start with basics then. As I said, 99.9 is probably a fair rounding point as well of what's out there at the moment, this fixed bottom offshore wind. What is it that we're talking about then when we say floating offshore wind? Maybe what is it and how does it differ to the fixed bottom side of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's one that keeps me very busy as well at the moment, trying to define exactly how we make these things float. Its fundamental difference is that rather than having a fixed structure like a jacket or a monopile attached to the seabed, we actually have a floating superstructure upon which the turbine's placed that then keeps the turbine buoyant. And the way that we make that stable and doesn't float off over the horizon with the first gust of wind is that we have mooring lines, which are either taut moored or slack moored. So the taut moored, in which case we have an up-down connection between the foundation and the seabed, which can be anchored in the seabed with drilled anchors or piled anchors or suction buckets. Or we have semi-taut or slack mooring systems where you effectively have mooring chain or, for example, nylon ropes connecting the foundation to the seabed to drag embedded anchors or suction bucket anchors, or again drilled or piled anchors. So you know these things are very heavily dependent on the technology that was developed for oil and gas, and I'm sure we'll come to that in a second in terms of transfer of skills and capabilities. It's a super exciting market space to be with, and the technologies are still in their, I'm not going to say infancy, that would be a disrespect to a couple of the companies that have led the charge with floating offshore wind, but there's certainly there is not a standard approach to floating offshore wind yet.
And I guess that's the point here is to start off with. So first of all, the difference really being that you've got a structure that floats, yeah, and you're essentially in whichever form you're talking about there, whether you're anchoring it, whichever way, to the seabed in some mm-hmm. respects, but you're missing all that structure you're going to have to build to essentially drill into the ground.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Or pile or whichever way you end up doing it. but the floating structures also themselves are of varying designs, right?
Correct.
So you've got the mooring aspect, but also the floating structure in itself, which is essentially being worked on by different companies because you can do it in many different ways.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, David. When you look at the types of structures for floating offshore wind, you can broadly specify that they are semi-subs, so semi-submersibles, and that's literally a structure that's been designed to be part in the water, part out of the water, and act as like a supporting structure. Usually has buoyancy modules on the edges and either the turbine in the center or on one side, with jacket type structures, struts in between to create the tensions required to make the whole thing stiff so it doesn't bend whenever the waves hit it. Then you've got barge type solutions where you have like super massive structures that can be tens of thousands of tons. Well, you tend to have the turbine either at one end or the center as well. They can be out of concrete, they can be out of steel. These things will generally have either a single point mooring solution or a slack mooring solution. There's also your TLP. TLP is very exciting for the oil and gas sector because tension leg platforms, what TLP stands for, is these taut mooring systems where you have an up-down mooring system connected directly to the floater itself, and it's tensioned and brings the floater farther into the water column. So that effectively creates a very rigid structure. And it's probably the closest thing that we have for floating offshore wind that replicates the type of loading that a wind turbine would expect to receive from a monopile or a jacket, because you create such a rigid structure. Even though you don't have, for example, a steel tube going all the way down or a jacket going all the way down, you just have these wires, if you like. Obviously, a bit more than wires, but you know what I mean. And then we mustn't forget Sparboy. Sparboy is that's B-U-O, boy, is a very exciting technology where effectively you create a pendulum, if you like. You have as much, if not slightly more, weight in a tube below the water as you do above with the wind turbine, and you counteract the wind turbine loads. Now, traditionally, you need very deep harbors to build Sparboy type solutions, which doesn't suit everywhere, but those areas that it does suit, it's an excellent technology to move forward with. because you can effectively build this thing in stages at the quayside. Say you have a fjord, which gives you a very geographic focus, and then install the turbine on top and then float the whole thing out. That's one if you needed to.
So there's, if I was to sort of summarize that in some respects, we've got a series of, okay, there are probably even multiple variations or within that, right?
Yes, but you
bucketed it, yeah. I looked at some of this myself. I remember that the diversity can be enormous, but you kindly bucketed it for us into those sort of four different areas.
That's right.
And that, I guess, gives you an indication of some of the things I'd like to talk about in a minute around the opportunity, but the challenge in some respects.
This only came to me last week, but... So I am aware. So I mentioned the four buckets, the types of technology that we can roughly categorize each of these technologies into.
Yes.
I am aware of 86 technologies.
86. Oh, wow.
Roughly into these four categories. So it's such a dynamic environment to be part of because, it's not anything goes. Clearly, the thing has to be designed to a certain standard and, there's requisite requirements. In terms of interaction with the turbines and that sort of thing. But it's very exciting to see so many different, very innovative solutions being brought to the market to address this. And from a supply chain perspective, it's super exciting. but we'll talk about that in a second, I'm sure.
I don't want to say this, but it almost sounds like the sexy part of the wind industry right now, because that's where a lot of the really new innovation happening. I don't want to be rude to anyone who's maybe on the blade side, because of course on the blade side there's lots of innovation happening there. We're talking about recycling and all these other areas, and it's exciting, right? There is that. But this category, if you think about, as you say, 86 different technologies that you could, okay, maybe bucket into those four different areas or so, none of them obviously a clear winner at this stage, and again we'll talk about that. That almost sounds like a really exciting clean tech area that should be coming out of Silicon Valley, where someone is essentially going to scale something in some shape or form. So its market dynamic is already extremely different to the fixed bottom market.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a time period in the fixed bottom offshore market where, people said, oh, we're only ever going to install offshore wind farms up to 20 meters. Then it was, 30, 40, 50. But realistically, the technology, the iterative changes within, for example, the jacket design didn't fundamentally shift away from being a jacket.
Yeah.
And similarly, the monopile design, it was still, no disrespect to the massive, massive, industrial developments that have happened in that space, but it was still a tube, it's a tube hammered into the ground some way or another. Looking at these four types of technologies across such a vast array of different technology innovations is very exciting.
So the question though is why are people doing this, right? So you started to allude to it a little bit there, water depth, those sorts of things. I'm sure you'll touch on that. But, I could phrase the question in many different ways, but I guess the horrible way would be, what's the point? But I guess the nicer way is, say, what's the benefit of choosing floating wind above continuing with the technology we've got right now and just incrementally improving that, taller, wider, bigger, etc., like the way that is, going up to Eiffel Tower scale wind turbines. Why go down this floating route? What are we going to get out of it?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. I think you're going to get a different answer depending who you ask on this. Okay. But my view is, I suppose, threefold. On the one hand, not everybody has shallow coastal waters, right?
Yeah.
So in order to democratize the opportunity of having offshore wind for every country, we needed to see some sort of step change in the technology evolution to be able to deploy in deeper waters. I mean, if you think about, the Southeast Asian markets, Pacific Island markets, these, they don't have sub 60 meter or very large tranches of sub 60 meter water depth seabed around their heavy population density areas on the coasts. So having a floating solution definitely drove that mechanic or that factor. Was driven by that factor, I think, to a certain degree. Then there's also the fact that the further you are from the coast, the cleaner the air. So you have a larger fetch of wind over open water without creating turbulence via having coastal lines, you know, buildings or whatever. And so you kind of you're putting yourself into a position where you can effectively predict the generation capacity of the wind farm a little more securely and longer term, because it's not like somebody's going to build a skyscraper between you and whatever, or even an oil rig. It's amazing when you look at the wind patterns, how quickly they change, even just with waves, never mind other structures on the water. And I'm not a specialist in that field, so I can't go into details about it, unfortunately, but it is an area that's worth exploring further. And the currently, my understanding, but the offshore wind farm with the highest capacity factor in the world is a floating offshore wind farm.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Right? My understanding is the same.
So we're in a situation where, yes, it costs more, at least compared to the, you know, established fixed bottom offshore market, but potentially there's an uplift in terms of the generation that you're actually able to realize. And it's not just about the wind fetch. It's also about the interaction between the turbine and the floating structure and how it softens the reaction. I'm not an engineer, so very simple
terms.
Nor
am I, Alex, so don't worry. Yeah.
The whole thing doesn't shudder, it bounces, or is it the other way around? But yeah. It's about rigidity, stiffness of the structure, and the natural springing of the water column.
So there's some sort of technical, call it benefits as such to it, but also commercial in some respects, because it opens up a whole new landscape. In theory, you could put it anywhere, right?
Yeah.
A floating wind farm. You don't have to have some of the issues. And my assumption also is maybe some of the seabed doesn't get as disturbed either. So from an environmental perspective, it also has its benefits and those sorts of things. There is also an area that I've seen people talk a lot about, which is if you've got a seabed, but you're nowhere near a market that maybe needs your electricity, what you can do is start to create all these floating, call them green hydrogen stations around the world and all those things. So apart from, you know, getting a better wind solution out there, offering up more of a commercial opportunity for the wind sector itself and for countries to become carbon neutral or whatever it is in their electricity sectors, there is also this opportunity to say, well, hang on, we can actually capture all this and create other green fuels or those sorts of things from that as well. That may be stretching the envelope a little bit, but again, but it does to me strike another reason why the industry appears to be excited by this, is because what you can do is utilize this technology in other ways to maximize the green angle of what you're trying to capture from the wind that's out there. I mean, is that fair as well, or do you think that's really very, very marginal in terms of what we're talking about?
Oh, I mean, it wouldn't be fair for me to judge whether that is a marginal application or not. I think there's certain validity in the expectation, in the sense that, you know, electrolysis, you know, it just needs a large power source to power effectively the process of splitting the water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then the compressors to compress it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's before we consider things like ammonia or, you know, what some other storage and transport option. Is it going to be the main driving factor of the deployment of offshore wind, floating offshore wind? I'm not sure. Okay. I think floating offshore wind is going to be driven more by the opportunity to deploy offshore wind in more markets than it is by the potential to be a producer of green hydrogen or other renewable fuel in an offshore environment. Having said that, and then coming to the next point that we should probably talk about, the transition of the oil and gas sector and the renewables market. Having said that, there is a natural overlap or parallel in terms of the capability statement and, you know, the areas of comfort that the current large energy sectors operate in. You know, if we are to create a new offshore energy fuel producing factory, if you like, rather than drilling for oil or drilling for gas, then creating natural, a green natural replacement product does make an awful lot of sense.
No, it's an interesting, and I think there's two things in your answer there, which are quite, I think, I wouldn't say revealing. Apologies in that sense, but the point is no one knows, right? Yeah. And this is part of what's interesting with this industry is there's lots of postulation, lots of ideas, lots of X number of technical possibilities of what you can do, but it's hugely uncertain as to what's actually going to happen to the industry, how it's going to interplay with things, and I guess the whole idea of floating wind to green hydrogen is just one I've come across a lot, because it's one that people like to talk about as an additional value add anyway. Yeah. In the offshore wind industry, right? I mean, if you go to any conference now, there'll always be a track of green hydrogen in some shape or form.
Sure.
Because yeah. It just makes sense in many ways. Yeah. But it's also a favorite of the industry in its own way. And look, I mean, we also had CIP on in our last series, and they were talking about, you know, could you do some of that? But yeah, again, your answer is I think is dead right. We don't know yet. Yeah. Could it be? Maybe. But it's not how everyone's thinking about the technology right now. It's just one of the things.
I mean, another way to look at it is the existing market. You know, there is a massive existing market for electrons, right? Yeah. We need power. We need power, and we need to displace all the power that we have on national networks and international networks with green electrons. So no matter what happens, that transition away from non-renewable and non-sustainable energy sources into green energy sources is going to happen. And that's, I think, going to be the major, I'm not an economist either, but my expectation would be that would be the major driving factor for more people, more countries who may be geographically disadvantaged against fixed bottom offshore wind to adopt floating offshore wind. Yeah. There is not currently an international market of sufficient size for green hydrogen. So there's going to be a lot of policy shifts required to move people down that path. Now, I love green hydrogen. I have to declare my bias here. And I genuinely think it is a fuel source of the future. In particular, if you count like agricultural resources and resource requirements around tractor fueling and that sort of thing, where batteries may not be the alternative fuel option because of the amount of power required for long durations. So I, you know, would urge any policymakers who think about this area to think about creating a new policy demand, a pull for green hydrogen solutions. So, absolutely. Future, massive opportunity. Right now, I need electrons. So right now, I think floating offshore wind is going to primarily be driven by giving more people an opportunity to tap into this stuff.
To round off maybe the opportunity bit, where you've mentioned this a couple of times, but it is that oil and gas overlap that is quite obvious. I'll let you say that rather than me. we are working on these things ourselves, right? But I'd like to get your opinion on this. You know, there is talk of the more obvious, should we say, overlap in the floating side of things with the oil and gas sector. Could you maybe just highlight a little bit around where that is and why? And you've alluded to it already, I suspect, but to me it's an important one, because it talks directly or indirectly to some of this just transition part of it aspect, as well as much as the nuts and bolts of how we're going to get this done. But it'd just be useful to hear from yourself, how are you seeing some of that overlap?
Absolutely. There was a paper, I think, maybe 3 years or 4 years old, that I read around the labor resource, personnel resource shortage for renewables. And this is, you know, this, I'm fairly new to floating offshore wind, so this would have been a fixed bottom offshore wind issue that was being highlighted. And it was somewhere in the region of 186,000 people required before 2030, of which there's currently a route to market for 27 or 30,000 in one market alone, right? And what that didn't account for, of course, were the thousands and tens of thousands of wonderfully clever men and women who are working on the oil and gas sector, who potentially could transition to the renewables market. Now, when you're working on a large floating or fixed bottom offshore production facility in, say, the southern North Sea, the transition from that to a fixed bottom offshore wind farm is not immediately obvious because, you know, we don't tend to have the wind farms populated with people as such. We're in, you know, shallower water, we're closer to shore, yada, yada. So it's a very different kind of mentality and process for becoming, you know, say an offshore wind technician or whatever. But when you look at the floating, you know, we're talking further from shore. We're potentially talking about, you know, mothership solutions in terms of having a large floating maintenance and repair solution that's either comes into shore, you know, once a day or once a week or once a month with, you know, rotations and that sort of thing. And you look at the physical structures themselves of being these super massive, either concrete or steel floating structures that are connected to the seabed, the amount of underwater aspects that need to be considered and, you know, visually surveyed and maintained. They're just all of a sudden the subsea sector of oil and gas becomes such a draw to me as a resource for labor and technical capability to satisfy the demand I'm going to have in offshore wind. I know that there's some great people out there doing some great work on getting the just transition stuff done. But I think more can be done. And I think there's so much opportunity to bring people over in a friendly manner rather than, you know, aggressively saying it's us or them. That can be done in the future. And I'm hoping to be able to support with that a little bit.
No, I certainly agree. And I mean, we'll talk about some of the challenges of the industry in just a minute. But you know, we come across this a lot, and people wonder how they can transfer or be part of it. And this is certainly one of the more obvious ones. So I guess people should reach out to you if they're looking for an opportunity to work through that. But okay. So opportunities as such are, you know, there are commercial opportunities, there are technical benefits to doing this. You know, there's a big scale opportunity out there more generally, environmental benefits more broadly, but also employment and longevity of the economy in some respects. So it sounds extremely positive as such, but there are always challenges at the same time. Without sort of asking you to do a list of things, why don't I hand it over to you then? You know, there are clearly a whole series of challenges, and some of them, I'm sure, will be order of importance, and there'll be local issues versus national issues and global issues, etc. But well, I guess the broader question is, what's kind of holding this industry not back, but what's the challenge they're facing? I mean, the fact you've got 86 different technologies is probably the most obvious one we've mentioned so far. But what are some of those challenges that the industry's facing and having to deal with? And how do we get from 0.1% to something a bit bigger?
Yeah, no, it is the thing that keeps me up at night at the moment is you know, this particular aspect is how do we make floating offshore wind not only cost competitive with fixed bottom offshore wind, but to get to that industrialized stage whereby we can churn these things out.
You know, but how much more expensive is it? Just to pause you there, how much more expensive are we talking
about? I couldn't possibly comment on that. it's less than you would imagine. But I think cost parity is a little way away. Having said that, ask me again once I've built my first floating offshore wind farm, and maybe I'll have some good news for you.
So obviously, you know, we look at our own models, we look at other people's things that we during our own sort of work that we do. And there is a lot of variance, right? But I guess the point is it's more expensive now.
Yeah, I mean, with a very strong supply chain flavor to my bias, you know, a lot of my headaches stem from turbines. Now, that's not to blame the turbines for the issue as such, you know, when I'm looking at 15 megawatt plus platforms, you know, for deployment in 2027, which is, you know, the kind of timelines that we're working to at the moment, these are big things. And when I say big things, there are maybe, you can count them on one hand, number of cranes that could lift the turbine nacelle and rotor into place. On these things, so we're talking 160 meter reach, you know, cranes required to just install the turbines onto the floaters at the point of floating out. Now, clearly, you know, there's a lot of work going on around maybe retroactively fitting jack-up solutions with just a taller crane. But then we're having to install the crane, the turbines in shallower water. There's the discussion around having a floating feeder barge solution to a supermassive, as I would call it, heavy lift vessel offshore, which is floating, which then is able to install whole components rather than having to lift stuff up to the top. But then that even more severely reduces the pool of vessels available to do that work, which obviously comes with an increased potential of risk and cost. So, you know, the turbines are projected to keep growing, and the crane suppliers are very happy to sell you crane or rent you crane as required, but it's by no means something that you'll find at every shop corner.
And you're going to have to start with smaller turbines then as a result, do you think? I don't want to say that because you've got a... Now, we do our own vessel forecast, right? We see these gaps in terms of what's expected, and that's even just in the next 10 years, 8 years, right? And that's mostly, we're talking about fixed here, right? And there's already a gap there. You're then talking about, on top of that, a whole variety of projects, which do have some uncertainty around timelines as well, which aren't the biggest projects in the world, right?
Yeah.
For fairness. Is that essentially another layer of complexity that a lot of them are still quite far out? You said 2027 for yourselves, but there'll be people 2030 onwards, et cetera, mm-hmm. who'll be looking at something. A lot of ScotWind arguably is 20. So this is the leasing rounds in Scotland is 2030 onwards in theory, mm-hmm. right?
That's right,
And so that's quite a timeline to think about these things. Good thing is you've got time. But are they all going to be using wind turbines that essentially are challenged with that vessel capability, or are we going to be choosing smaller wind turbines so you can get around that and the focus is going to be on some other aspects like the floating structure itself and working through that cost and design around that?
I don't think there's a binary response to that. I think unfortunately it's another question to your question, and that is at what point do I sacrifice the potential increased generation capacity of the larger turbines just because I can't find a damn crane?
Doesn't come down to that, but yeah. It's an interesting discussion point. Yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating, and it's completely valid, and I'm certain that there are other players in this market space who are actively choosing smaller turbines or current generation turbines to focus on what's available right now, even for the later generation of projects for that very reason.
But I guess that was a really interesting example of the type of complexity that you're dealing with and that you have to think through.
I think, you know, again, it kind of feels like I'm punching on the wind turbine suppliers, which I'm absolutely not.
No.
But I do wonder quite frequently where the market would be if we, say, had 10 major contenders for offshore wind turbines rather than less than 10.
true, but on the flip side, I'm not going to defend anybody on this podcast, but I guess the difficulty, of course, is also who's making money right now in that part of the world, and that's the complexity. Now, offshore is slightly different to onshore, so yeah, got to put our hands up there and be careful what we say. But essentially, you know, it is a growing fast market where cost is trying to be managed and dealt with, and who's the winner and loser, and that's quite an interesting. Probably a separate podcast at some space.
Yeah, I think so. And certainly, you know, my conversation with the wind turbine suppliers is they are I don't want to say they're under-resourced. That's not the word I'm looking for. I'm looking for they're so busy.
Yeah, absolutely. They are.
You know, they're so busy with not just floating offshore wind, of course, because we represent a microscopic proportion of the total offshore wind market at this stage. But, you know, with the fixed bottom as well, all around the world, it's growing.
Just highlights a very high level, essentially, the complexity of an industry. And this is every industry or where technology is changing fast. Investment timelines are still quite long in some respects. But how do you react to something which, you know, isn't yet set in stone in some respects? Yeah. And this is the question I guess I was trying to sort of skirt around a little bit. Is do you think that sort of that lack of standardization we currently have in the industry And I'm talking about, you know, the floating foundation types, or the, you know, the sort of 86 or so different technologies we've talked about. Is that a concern, or is that a benefit to the industry, right? Because you could talk about creative destruction and innovation and getting the right solution, and isn't one size fits all, and those sorts of things. But you could also talk about confusion, complexity, and delay in some respects. So just out of interest from your perspective, and if you can't answer it, that's fine. But would you see there's a benefit, or do you think that's still a concern for the industry?
Well, I mean, it segues quite neatly into my next challenge, and that is around ports.
Yeah.
Right. So if we break down the challenges with regards to, so obviously design of a floater is one thing. Then you've got the sourcing of the materials. Then you've got the fabrication of the components. Then you've got the assembly of the components. Then you've got the finishing of the whole structure, including secondary steel, painting, etc. Then you've got deployment into the water or onto a barge or whatever. So logistics around getting it to the point that you need to have it. And then you've got the turbine integration. Now, we've talked about the turbine integration at the outset, about the size of the market available in terms of turbine suppliers, but also the size of the market available for the cranes to install these giant turbines. But if we look at the ports, you know, one of the reasons I got into floating offshore wind that really excited me about floating offshore wind was the potential ability of floating offshore wind to divvy up more slices of the cake to more regions, areas of expertise, et cetera, et cetera. I think multi-port staging strategies is very much on the books still for floating offshore winds. And, you know, I'm very excited about the possibility, at least for our couple of floating offshore wind projects, to, you know, give lots of people a bite at the cherry rather than focusing all of our efforts on one supermassive industrialized cluster that's already integrated and ready to go, sort of thing. And, you know, clearly local, regional, local content requirements are going to drive this conversation one way or another. But, you know, whether it's the fabrication of the components or the assembly of the components or the mooring lines or the turbine integration, or even just storing components during the construction or the long-term O&M. There's so many opportunities for, you know, regional local port facilities to set themselves up to be ready to support floating offshore wind. Now, coming to your question, very often the cry I hear from port facilities is, if only they would standardize, then I could project what facilities I need. Okay. And it's an absolutely valid point that the port facilities raise, that they don't know what investments required because they don't know what they're catering for. I mean, a concrete barge can be, I mean, one of the technologies I've been looking at, there's a concrete barge solution, which is very mature and is 6 times the size of a steel semi-sub that I'm looking at. And they could equally be appropriate for projects. And, you know, if I'm a port facility and I'm going, right, so I now need, you know, X number of, you know, volume of concrete production facility of this type in order to satisfy these, you know, Y number of concrete barges. And then somebody says, oh, no, we've decided to go for steel. You go, well, okay. It's a completely different facility. That's a completely different fabrication capability. What do I do? So I suppose the main thing is from a port's perspective is to me to focus on the here and now, which is all what are the commonalities across these technologies, right? I like to think of port facility requirements in 100 by 100 meter areas, you know, and we say, oh, I might just pull a number out of the sky. I think 20 tons per square meter is what we recommend for port facilities to go with in terms of a quayside you know, loading requirement. It can be adjusted so that it's only the point load for the center mass that has to be that high, and everything else can be done with spreader beams and or spreader pads and whatever. But then it's also getting the stuff off the quayside into the water. Do you have some sort of slipway system, or do you have, again, a supermassive crane that has to lift the whole structure in one and then drop it in the water? Are you dropping these things into the water at all, or are you putting them onto a barge, a feeder barge, and then floating them across the world to be deployed where they're needed? All these questions need answering. Would I be able to improve the efficiency of deployment scenarios for ports and investment scenarios specifically for ports by standardizing and saying, right, we're all going to use this solution or this solution? Probably. But I would be surprised how many ports would actually secure that investment at the same time. Whereas I think having a variety of technologies allows different ports to specialize. So I'm not going to sit here and say which ports geographically need to specialize in what technology. But if I have a limited quayside frontage or shallow water around my quayside, but I happen to have a concrete plant next door, come on, guys, not rocket science. Whereas if I have the ability to roll steel on site or create, high-grade steel plates, and I happen to have 1,000 welders that work on another facility on my quayside, come on, guys, not rocket science. Let's focus our efforts and our intentions, attentions and intentions on the technology that suits what I've got, and then let's look at quayside investment in order to actually host these things when they're being either fabricated or assembled or loaded out. Sorry, the loaded out has to come the second one.
But I'm assuming you need a partner for that, right? So you need a developer or a group of developers to come out and go, we actually think that this port can benefit us as well. So, and we're going to specialize in this technology, because you do need a bit of demand outlook in some respects.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
There's no doubt. Clearly you're not going to go and speculatively invest hundreds of millions or tens of millions of pounds into a quayside facility on a vague idea that there is going to be floating wind requirements out there somewhere. Yeah. But what us developers are quite willing to do is give you a target market. We're willing to sit down with the facilities, the port facilities, and say, look, this is our projections. These are our projections. Speak English, Alex. These are our projections, and this is the size of the challenge that we're going to present you with, and the timeline. And then the infrastructure investment troops need to then come back and say, well, we can't be ready for this. What's your plans afterwards? Or, well, if we do this, we can provide you with this. It's about dialogue. It's about having the iterative call and response on these things, the push-pull. The one thing that we need to think about in that context, though, is it going to be at a premium than importing the whole damn thing? Mm. So that's another topic, I think.
No. I sat down with a steel company yesterday, actually, and talked through what opportunity do they see in this space. And interesting that they were just confused, actually, in some respects, because they didn't quite know how they could help in one way. And I know conversations are happening, right? But because it's such an early stage market for them, how to get involved and what to do is still an early stage. But it's true. The point is there is an opportunity. There is something they can do, and the conversations are starting. But what I've liked so far, actually, about what you've talked about here is typically when you talk to someone about floating wind, they'll say, look, it's about cost reduction, it's about standardization, and it's about maximizing local benefit, right? Because essentially that's what the law tells you should do. Or I mean, it's not always the law. It's a gentleman's agreement in some countries versus the law. So let's wash over that a little bit. But that's essentially what we're talking about. But what I like is you've boiled it down to actually something a bit more realistic around what's needed to make it happen, right? So there are certain factors that are just out of control. There are certain local opportunities, technologies, developers, and all these things. It's a much more fragmented market. That doesn't mean suddenly, as you kind of alluded to in a different part of the sector, it doesn't mean you suddenly need two or three developers who are going to do this with this technology, and that's the answer, and you need six big ports around the world to do it. Actually, there's quite I don't want to use it fragmented because that's typically seen as negative, but I'll still use it anyway. A more localized opportunity here where people can take control of this and go, look, here, this is what I want to achieve. This is how we do it. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. Yes, there's some investment required, but if people sign up for it, they can get local benefits. They can develop the technology that's appropriate and that's going to work, and they can do it in a cost-effective manner.
Absolutely. And if I look at my execution models, and I look at the cost benefit of shipping something hundreds of miles across open sea, fully assembled even if it's without the turbine, versus, you know, finishing it off locally, assembling it locally, or fabricating it locally and then deploying it in the water just a couple of kilometers from the site that it ends up living on.
Yeah,
it does. There's a lot of benefits to be had. Now, I can't promise that those benefits directly counterweigh, maybe enhanced labor costs for some regions versus others and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a cost benefit analysis that needs to be undertaken for each wind farm, each floating wind farm in and of its own. I had to giggle though when you're talking about standardization though, from like I say, 18 years of offshore wind, both the development and supply chain side of things. I would love to ask those respondents, what is a standard wind farm? I've lost count how many offshore wind farms I've been involved in, and never were the two the same.
Yeah, and I guess it does come down to that, what you're saying, the initial component angle is what people are looking for, cost reductions, right? Essentially, that's what they're focused on, and they're looking for ways, and it often comes down to, how do I manufacture and install, essentially, this particular wind farm, and then therefore, which bit can I standardize? It's pretty much a question you ask when you're building a car, when you're, you know, of course, you can get every version of leather, and some people drive on the left, other people drive on the right, whatever, right? But you're trying to create a platform that you can work from. And I guess that's the same here. But actually, what you're saying is, I think, is slightly different in the sense of, even from the construction installation phase of things, there is actually benefit to a bit more locality and not pure standardization and mass scale. While that might be nice to hear for some people, actually there is also a localization angle to it.
And I think it doesn't just start and stop with the construction aspects. You know, O&M cannot be overlooked, right? Having a local O&M base to the wind farm is just the logical thing to do. And particularly when you have regional clusters, such in the Celtic Sea, being able to share an O&M base and O&M vessels just makes an awful lot of sense. I don't know how that's going to work contractually between the developers, particularly as we're competing against each other for the same CFDs. But in principle, you know, there's lots of opportunities there. And looking even further or earlier into the supply chain, if you look at the raw materials, obviously, with the current problems in the world, steel price has gone bananas.
Yeah.
And if the steel price comes down significantly enough, I would welcome a conversation with a broker or some wholesaler trader who decides, right, we're going to stockpile the steel at this price and then guarantee the developers a fixed price for their steel going forward, based on a whatever. These sort of conversations need to happen, because if ultimately you're talking about tons of steel per megawatt, and that tons of steel is going up 100% year on year in terms of price, obviously we're not that bad yet, but if it did, then that changes the fundamental economics of the wind farm. And finding local partners who are willing to combine forces and say, well, let's see if we can solve that issue, is an untapped area for me.
Yeah, I'm not a contractual expert, but maybe a CFD pass-through mechanism could be an interesting one. When everyone either sort of benefits or not across the supply chain, you all equally benefit and guarantee a sort of margin, and that's where, you know, you're encouraged to get involved. But
that'd be interesting.
Probably verging off a little bit there, but look, I mean, time always runs away from us, but I do kind of have just, I want to go back up to the macro scale. I'm sure we've missed that, lots of good points, unfortunately, but you know, time is never our friend in these things. So I know we've run out of time a little bit talking through some of those really interesting sort of commercial and opportunities, but also the challenges of making that market happen. I would say with quite a positive tint, to be frank with you, but if we take it back up to the macro level, where would you say are kind of the markets that we're talking about for this? Which ones are going to go first, and sort of why?
For deployment at scale, or do you mean?
So, okay, maybe it's just at a very high level, kind of just painting the picture where some of this stuff is happening. You talked about demonstrators. You talked about some of the things your company's doing, etc. But where essentially is this market sort of starting to blossom, and where is the opportunity starting to look, you know, grow, etc. So for transparency, we track the pipeline of projects, so I have an indication of that in my head.
Yeah,
but as you, as a player, you know, who's in the market day to day, where you see things blossom, and where you where's the market looking like it's going to start to grow first?
Good question. For floating offshore wind specifically.
Floating, right? Excuse me. Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly I'm going to say the Celtic Sea. The Celtic Sea is a supreme example of a staged approach, a stepping stone approach, where, you know, you've got gigawatt scale ambitions for offshore wind deployment in the Celtic, Southern Celtic Sea, and the Celtic Sea in broader sense. You know, the approach is to go for the kind of sub 300 megawatts first, you know, before 2030, and then thereafter going into the pre-commercial and commercial scale wind farms. So I think that's very exciting. Clearly hot on its heels to me with a UK bias is ScotWind, yeah, and the announcements there. You know, it's exciting to see the amount of floating offshore wind that was in incorporated within the ScotWind leases, and I'll be following that market extremely closely, as it's also on my doorstep. Thereafter, I mean, I don't actually know the timelines on Korea and South Korea, but I hear that a lot about that being a market to watch closely. I'm sure you guys know better than me. And
I mean, the question is always about timeline, but it's also about scale of projects, right? So countries that surprise me a little bit are places like Sweden, Australia, you know, places like that, which you rarely hear about if you think about, you know, the grand scheme of things. And you maybe hear me maybe more about places like Japan, but actually Japan's quite a small pipeline, and it's still a little bit further away. So some of these other countries that have popped out, actually with some big pipelines, big opportunities, questions around timescale for sure.
I think
are the ones we're looking at as well.
Yeah, one market that you haven't mentioned there is the West Coast of the US.
And, true.
You know, that market space to me, in terms of industrial scale deployment of tens of gigawatts of floating offshore wind, because let's be realistic, in terms of fixed bottom offshore wind, there's going to be a limited availability off the West Coast of the US. So if BOEM is going to move forward with their recently announced leasing rounds,
yes,
that's going to go big guns for floating.
True.
And clearly that's one of the reasons that we're in the West Coast of the US with our four turbine demonstrator on Kademo, before they've even made a decision. They progress.
Oh, there's certainly appetite out there. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And you know, he does require things like a leasing round to unleash some of this, which is fair, right? Versus folks just coming up with project ideas, coming out there and saying, here you go, right? And obviously a lot of the projects are much smaller scale right now. So
yeah.
So when we do talk about it, and you alluded to it, right, the sub 300 megawatt, and what we're talking about, gigawatt scale projects right now, fixed. So there is still a size difference. So it's always a bit unfair to compare things on a gigawatt basis. So look, last question, and it's a single answer that you need to give, I'm afraid. What's your estimate for 2030 floating wind installations? Should I tell you ours, and then we're around a 15 gigawatt.
15 gigawatts of floating wind by 2030.
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say 2.
Wow, look at that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
You'd be flying in. I mean, essentially, look, if I was to sort of look at what we've got, if you look at, call it our competitors, if you look at GWEC as well, and all these other guys that put out forecasts, we're all in a similar sort of ballpark. Some are actually much higher than that.
By 2030.
By 2030.
So installed and operational by 2030.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, cool. Hey, who am I to question that?
We should talk more about that afterwards.
Yeah.
But yeah, interesting, right? So there is the market is going to grow superbly fast because there are a lot of little things going on around the world that surprise people. And, you know, the pipeline is big. Mm. You know, the pipeline of projects is really, really big around the world. If you take, you know, Sweden, I think we've got 18 gigawatts against it as pipelines that are already of projects that are already being announced as something that they would like to do. Now, these are on concept phase, granted, right? And they're far, far out. But think about that. You know, there are big opportunities. But it's interesting to listen to you too. No, but it's interesting to listen to you around the supply chain challenges.
I'd be even keener. I think trying to identify those markets that haven't been tapped yet.
Well, that list is long. I tell you that. That list is That's long.
What I like to hear. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Music to my ears. Music to my ears.
Absolutely. That's another whole area in itself. But okay, look, I mean, that's what we're looking at there. And it's so fascinating to hear your, I don't want to say, you know, the 2 versus 15 or something. Yeah. We shouldn't use those as perfect numbers because we, you know, as I think our conversation kind of said today is essentially it's all of uncertainty, right? Yeah. And that's part of it. But even 15 gigawatts would make the market only something like 4% of the total installed base, right? So it's still a smidgen, if you don't mind me saying it in those words. Yeah. And it is a post-2030 story, is probably a realistic phrase to use. But yeah, that's fascinating. So
exciting. Yeah, I mean, it's a super exciting market space to be part of. You know, I'm really looking forward to where we're going to be in the next 10 years. I think you're right. I think it's the real story is the post 2030 scale of deployment. At what point are we going to outpace fixed bottom offshore wind with floating offshore?
Ooh, this could become like a nice trivia podcast.
Yeah. Just so I can see a nice little like double curve. That's the sort of thing I think. Yeah. That'd be very, very exciting.
There's a lot of fixed bottoms still to go, right?
I know. That's why I mentioned it. You know? Yeah. So many markets. So little time.
All right. With that, Alex, thank you so much for your time. We did go over time a little bit, I think, for what we planned, but I think it was definitely worth it. We covered this huge amount there. So thank you for essentially taking time out of your good day to share that all with us.
Thank you, David. It's an absolute pleasure to speak to you again. And I look forward to seeing the other fantastic recordings and podcasts that you guys release over the coming years. I'll be watching them closely, listening to them closely.
Wonderful.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. And thanks, everyone, for listening as well. Hope you enjoyed that one. Please make sure you subscribe, give us a good rating, share with your friends, and talk to you next time.